This is an ABC podcast.
For some people, fishing is a fun hobby. It's a chance to get some peace and quiet. Maybe for too many guys, it's an opportunity to get another big fish pick for their dating profiles. But for a lot of coastal First Nations communities, fishing is a crucial part of their cultural identity, and they're being stopped from practicing it. Some even end up behind bars. G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack this NAIDOC week, and soon we're going to hear from young Indigenous fishers about what's going on here and how they're feeling about it. Also coming up, a diet that could help you live 20 years longer. Is that for real? First though,
Hack.
The recovery phase from this one is going to be even more challenging. I mean, there's a compounding effect every time this happens on people's mental health.
On Triple J.
Yeah, more rain, more communities back underwater. You've probably seen the pics on the news of the flood crisis smashing Sydney at the moment, and you're thinking, how many times has this happened again? Well, it's the fourth flooding emergency in New South Wales in 18 months. Thousands of people again evacuated. Emergency crews, they're flat out with floodwater rescues, and we're being told that there could be a lot more devastation to come. Look, if you've been affected by this, I'd be interested to hear from you, like, how are you dealing with it? How many times have you been evacuated over the past few months? You can let me know, 0439 757 555. In the meantime, Edwina's story's got the latest.
300 millimetres of rain is predicted to fall across Sydney over the next few days. That's three times the average amount for July.
We are about to be pummeled. There is a severe weather warning for heavy rainfall tomorrow, and we could see 6-hourly totals between 80 and 150 millimetres. That could also lead to flash flooding through the Illawarra and also in the Sydney Basin.
This is not what people in Greater Sydney wanted to be hearing. Areas like Camden and Windsor and North Richmond that had barely caught a breath since the last flood, and the one before that, were having to prepare all over again.
Shortly, the SES will be issuing dozens of evacuation orders and warnings. If you were safe in 2021, do not assume you will be safe tonight.
It's a repeat of a situation, a fourth flood, in fact, this year already for residents there.
It's devastating. It's the worst kind of deja vu imaginable. We've just battled through the last horrific floods, and here we are finding ourselves for a fourth time facing them again.
The Hawkesbury, Nepean and Kohler rivers all flooded and still are, and the bridges that connect Windsor and North Richmond to Sydney have been swallowed by water, leaving residents stranded on the other side with no sign of the rain easing up.
The government has made it very clear that we're in the middle of an emergency.
Thousands of residents are under evacuation orders this morning, while more than 130 rescues have taken place in what's been described as a life-threatening emergency situation.
All I can say is that if you're subject to an evacuation order, please don't waste a moment. Get out now.
There were 83 rescues from floodwaters on Sunday night, and the Hawkesbury River is expected to peak this arvo. And even though people are traumatised, they're also just tired. Tired of being on alert, tired of evacuating, tired of being stranded.
When people do get stuck, there is one way out, but it's not that safe. It takes like 2 or 3 hours each way. Last time it flooded, some of the road gave way from all the erosion.
Yeah, and beyond feeling like they've been kicked in the guts multiple times by Mother Nature, people are wondering why our flood warning systems just don't seem up to scratch when it comes to giving people enough time to prepare.
Could still get worse. We're particularly concerned about the Hawkesbury River, which has not yet peaked. And as you know, that's an area which has already suffered three floods in just the last 18 months or so. So they're now heading into their fourth.
Hack on Triple J.
Edwina's story with that update, and we're hearing from you. Reese says, I live near Warragamba Dam, and apparently the flooding got as high as March levels on the weekend after just the second day of rain. Yeah, the scenes are so devastating to see entire communities underwater, roads, shops, businesses, homes. I want to talk a bit now about how we predict events like this, big floods like the ones we're seeing in New South Wales, because experts are saying that as the climate changes, our predictions are actually getting worse. Sally Thompson is an associate professor at the University of Western Australia, and she's been kind enough to join us now. Sally, thanks for jumping on Hack.
It's a pleasure, thanks.
How do we predict floods in Australia?
Yeah, so what we usually do is look at histories of rainfall and how rain has come in terms of how long storms are and how much water they're dumping. And we look at that over the past. And then we use that to tell us about the risk of having equally big rainfall events. And with that information, we take what we know about the rain and we run models of how water is going to move around on the landscape, into our dams, into our rivers, through our cities, and make predictions of floods with that. So we've sort of got the rainfall forecasting bit, and then we've got the flood prediction bit.
Right. And I imagine in the past this has worked pretty well, like in decades past, has it? What's it been like?
Well, it's mostly been okay. We have in Australia not the longest of rainfall records because we've obviously, you know, we're a colonial society. We've only been measuring rain and river flow here for 150 years, maybe 200 years in some places. And that makes it pretty hard to say with confidence how often you're going to see extreme events, just because doing statistics when you don't have that much information is a bit challenging. But the whole thing has just become so much harder because with climate change, the past is no longer a good guide to the future.
Yeah, because I was seeing that, you know, the technique that's used a lot around the world now to predict floods, a figure that said, you know, we are underestimating flood peaks by like 200% seems crazy, right?
Yeah, well, that's for one particular method and there's a whole toolkit out there. The one that's underestimating things quite a bit is mostly used in our cities at fairly small scales. And so that's probably not the same technique that you'd be using to think about what's happening in Sydney right now, where you'd be using much more sophisticated tools.
So what do we need to do to improve things? Like are experts and scientists, people who know a lot about this area, like you, working on strategies that we can use to better predict floods?
Look, I think there's a few things going on. One is that you're seeing a lot of people today on the socials saying, oh God, you know, this is the fourth time this year we've had the one in 100-year flood. How's that happening? This makes no sense. And partly that's us in the flood world doing a bad job of communicating ideas of risk, because the idea of a one in 100-year flood really does not mean the flood that you only see once every 100 years, but a flood that if you average things out over thousands and thousands of years, it'd be coming around about once every 100 years, and there's nothing to say that it couldn't happen three times in 1 year. So to some of it is actually getting better at talking about it. I think a chunk of this is going to be getting away from the numbers a little bit. And, you know, it's often a lot of engineering types who do this flood work. We love a number, but it's not necessarily super appropriate to say, oh, for sure, this is the one in 100-year flood when we know the climate's changing. And what we may need to be doing is just saying to people, well, are you in an area that's likely to see flooding? Are we going to see more of it? What do we do about that? Maybe rather than being quite so prescriptive and numbers driven, being a bit more scenario driven. And then I think there's a sort of arms race going on between how well we can understand and predict our climate and our weather, what's going on in our catchments, and how rapidly it's changing and throwing surprises at us. So there's quite a lot to do.
Yeah, it does seem like there's quite a bit to work on. We've got some comments coming through from our listeners. Somebody says, our governments are directly responsible for their inaction on climate change policies and active blocking of policies that would have stopped this. Another person says, modelling probability, then price the risk. Another person, Andrew, an engineer, says, I'm literally looking at flood design for a project in Africa right now. One issue that people think that the 100-year storm should happen every 100 years. In reality, the probability of the 100-year storm occurring is 1% every year, and that's 1% chance of that storm or something bigger. That's why the Bureau of Meteorology is now using 1%, not 1 in 100 years, which is interesting, Sally. I guess we have seen a lot of commentary about why we should see those terms changing in recent weeks and months. I'm wondering about urban planning as well, because a lot of communities are already built on floodplains, and we're seeing that in parts of Sydney now, but in the future, do we really need to be looking more closely at how we're building communities?
Yeah, and I think to the first comment that, you know, the government's directly responsible for not having fixed climate change, look, we need to do everything we can to mitigate climate change, but we would be facing this scenario even if Australia had gone completely renewable 30 years ago, right? Because the rest of the world hasn't. So the issue around planning and adaptation is the really critical one. And, you know, Western Sydney, it's been known for a really, really long time that this was about developing inside the 1-in-100-year floodplain, that we had had statewide planning policies that said don't go there, which were actively scrapped by previous governments. And so to some extent, developers have gone into this with their eyes open and saying we're going to develop and sell land and encourage people to live in places that are exposed to this risk. And that's probably really nice if you're selling land in the short term. And it's really nasty if you need to deal with the consequences of then having people living in these areas that are basically dangerous areas to be, because protecting communities at risk is hard, it's expensive, it's not always possible. So the best jolly thing we can do is not put people, not put communities in places that are high risk.
And those communities that are already there, I guess there's a lot of conversations that have got to be had about what can be done to further protect them, I guess.
Yeah, and that can really range from social adaptation, so people having better preparedness, managing their property in ways that they can evacuate rapidly and minimise damage. That can be a focus on making sure that escape routes from communities are actually safe and don't themselves get cut off in floods. You can start thinking about what engineers would call hardening, which is really putting up flood levees and protection. There was some really amazing use of portable flood levees up in the Queensland floods earlier this year that were quite effective. But anytime you build a levee, right, you're creating haves and have-nots. You've got the community behind the levee and you've got the people who are outside of it. So that's a bit of a challenge as well. There's a whole insurance issue. And then at the absolute worst end of the spectrum, you can start looking at trying to buy people out of their land and relocate them, which is also really expensive and usually results in a pretty rough deal for people who have to move. So it becomes really, really challenging.
And I guess people, when they hear that with the climate warming, there's going to be more risk of flooding, the science behind that's really interesting, right? Because it's because, what are the reasons behind that? It's because the heat means we're trapping more moisture in the atmosphere, right?
Yeah, right. So if you've ever experienced a really, really high humidity day, like nearly 100% humidity, and you've got sweat beading down your face, how much water is actually in the air on that day would change with the temperature. So you can be at 100% humidity and there's different amounts of water in the air when it's cold and when it's warm. And so the warmer the air gets, the more water vapour it can hold before it gets to 100% humidity, before that water starts forming into rain or sweat on your face or whatever. So the hotter the climate gets overall, the greater the volume or the mass of water that we can have in the air. Now, if you imagine that and then you say, well, let's flick a switch and we'll turn all of that water in the air into liquid, well, obviously, the hotter it was, the more you've got, the more that's there to fall out of the sky and give you these extreme rainfall events.
Oh, really interesting. Appreciate you breaking it down so well for us. Professor Sally Thompson from the University of Western Australia, thanks for being with us on Hack.
That's a pleasure.
NAIDOC Week on Triple J.
It's time to get up, stand up and show up.
Yeah, when it comes to fishing around the country, there are strict rules about who can do it, how and where. But First Nations people have been practicing cultural fishing for thousands of years. Catching a feed for their family and community sustainably is a key part of identity for so many saltwater people. They've got their own rules and they've been passed down through generations. So it might surprise you to hear that Indigenous Australians on the New South Wales South Coast say they're being harassed by fisheries officers and aggressively denied a right to their traditional food sources. Some have ended up in jail. There's been a lot of talk about laws to help First Nations fishers in New South Wales, but years have passed and they're still waiting. This story from Walbunja Country from reporter Kira Proust and Vanessa Milton.
Other cultures, like tribes up in the middle of Australia, they learn to go hunt for kangaroos or do that stuff. and we get taught this.
That's 18-year-old Ewan man Jeremiah Mason Campbell from Narooma on the New South Wales far south coast. Jeremiah and his brother Kevin started learning to fish and dive with their granddad when they were little kids, but they've already seen how practicing their traditional culture can get them in trouble with the law. They say they've witnessed their pop being stopped on the beach by police, his car searched by fisheries officers, and facing charges in court.
It was pretty embarrassing when they send us to court and make us look stupid when we're helping, like, you know, we're getting taught how to help, like, you know, help out everybody else then before ourselves and also ourselves, like, help out everyone.
That's Jeremiah's brother, Kevin. These are some of the experiences being looked at in a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry, which is investigating why crucial legislation made to protect cultural fishing has sat on the shelf for over a decade. To get technical, the specific legislation is known as Section 21AA of the 2009 New South Wales Fisheries Management Amendment Act. And that legislation makes special provision for an Aboriginal person in New South Wales to take or possess fish for cultural fishing purposes, despite other limits being in place.
For a small amendment to sit there for 11, 12 years and plus and not be commenced and nothing happened with it, it just sort of sit there and no sort of rescission motion or explanation. For me, that was quite extraordinary.
That's the chair of this ongoing inquiry, Mark Benaziak, from the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers Party. There's already been a bunch of submissions made by Indigenous people into this inquiry, which detail instances of harassment and aggressive treatment by authorities while cultural fishing. Wilbunja Ewan man, Stuart Davison, has made a submission.
It's come to a point where I won't go and get nice diving gear. I'll get hand-me-down stuff because, I mean, I'm too scared to go and buy a nice $600 wetsuit in fear of being taken off me, innocent or guilty.
These experiences are something charity organisation Oxfam Australia has called out as a form of human rights abuse. Here's their policy and advocacy lead, Paul Cleary.
We see what's gone on here, particularly on the South Coast, as a form of human rights abuse because people have been systematically and quite aggressively denied a right to their traditional food sources. And we actually see that in a way as a denial of a right to life because this is something that's an inherent part of Aboriginal culture.
So what have those in charge had to say? Well, the New South Wales government says it does support the rights of cultural fishers, but the reason why it hasn't implemented the legislation it's passed is because they say there needs to be an agreement reached with peak Aboriginal bodies about what catch limits should be in place for cultural fishing. That's something Aboriginal people and fishing rights advocates have hit back against, arguing they never gave away their rights to fish sustainably under their own law and custom. Here's Jeremiah again.
My ancestors have been teaching their younger generation for thousands of years, and for them to try to stop it, it's bad. I don't feel good. It hurts me, especially doing it to an elder.
According to data from the New South Wales Bureau of Crime Statistics and Research, Aboriginal people are being disproportionately prosecuted for fisheries offences. More than 200 Indigenous fishers have been prosecuted in the state since this legislation to protect cultural fishing was passed in 2009.
On average, Aboriginal people are about 10 times overrepresented in our prisons. But if you look at these fisheries-related prosecution data that we've obtained, they are 22 times overrepresented for prison sentences. I mean, that is just unbelievable.
This type of prosecution has really affected how young Indigenous people like Jeremiah and Kevin feel.
Treating us like convicts, pretty much.
Just nasty, the way they go on.
The inquiry is expected to hear from people on the ground later this month once hearings kick off. It's uncertain how this inquiry will help improve the lives of Indigenous fishers and their families, but regardless of the outcome, it's clear many Aboriginal people like Stuart are committed to keeping this tradition alive for the generations to come.
It does break the spirit a bit, but I'm pretty stubborn, so I just, well, you know what I mean? If I believe I'm doing the right, I'll keep going. So I've just got to keep going and I'll continue to teach my kids that we're not actually doing anything wrong. And I make them believe that because we're actually not.
Hack,
on Triple J.
That's story from Kira Proust and Vanessa Milton. On the text line, someone says, Indigenous Australians know how to do controlled burning better than we do. Surely they know how to fish sustainably too. When will we learn?
Hack. Growing up, I watched a lot of Marvel and DC and reading a lot of these comic books. And, you know, never seen that, I guess, Indigenous representation.
NAIDOC Week on Triple J.
Yeah, it is NAIDOC Week. Such an important time for us to celebrate and recognise the history, the culture, the achievements of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And there are so many incredible young First Nations Australians doing amazing things every day. And we want to use NAIDOC Week on Hack to tell you about them. Today, we're going to hear from Dylan. He's a young Indigenous artist in North Queensland, and through his work, he's reimagining the typical image that we all have of superheroes. This is Dylan's story.
Hello, my name's Dylan Mooney. I'm a Yui man from Mackay. My family also come from the Torres Straits, from Darnley Island. And on my father's side, my family come from the Solomons and Vanuatu. Based in Brisbane here, and I grew up in Mackay, up in North Queensland as well. I did art class in high school, and then mum put me in art lessons outside of school. Yeah, and then I took it on to university. But yeah, I never thought I'd be a practicing artist, making a living out of it and everything. So yeah, pretty special to be doing that, what I love. Like growing up, I watched a lot of Marvel and DC and reading a lot of these comic books. Never seen that Indigenous representation. So, you know, I wanted to create that for myself. So just, I guess, developing these characters from the people that are in my life and who I look up to as well, whether it be people that work at the Indigenous health centres in Mackay or, you know, like my grandfather, who's worked for 27 plus years for our Native Title determination. And my grandmother, who is part of the Murray Court and does visitations to mob in the prisons. You know, it seems like it's nothing much, but I guess to me it's very special. So I've been doing a lot of digital illustrations, comic book style, animation, putting in a lot of, I guess, native plants, designs, and also making reference to the LGBT community as well, you know, being a part of that community and getting to more of my traditional works, my drawings on paper, my printmaking on paper. So that's revolving around state archives, museum collections, and recreating those images. You know, being able to see these objects that have just been sitting on these shelves in these institutions, making that connection that has been, I guess, not lost in a way, but kind of fractured. You know, giving these objects new life. So I wanted to, you know, put that into these superheroes and, you know, creating those backstories and these origin stories, you know, just giving these characters foundation. And, you know, it's a lot of truth telling behind these superheroes as well, you know. So, yeah, just to get people to, yeah, resonate with these characters as well. Hopefully they'll be able to see themselves within these characters. You know, I always try to make it home for NAIDOC, but this year I'll be in Cairns for NAIDOC Week. And it's exciting just to see how other, I guess, towns and cities celebrate as well. Yeah, just being surrounded by culture. Yeah, and it's just beautiful just to see, you know, the dancing, language, cultural stories being told, and it's pretty meaningful and special to always get back home and, you know, be a part of the community there. You know, fighting for what we believe in, fighting for our voices to be heard. Just continuing the work that our elders and those who have come before us and our, you know, our ancestors, continuing on their legacy.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Yui man Dylan Mooney sharing a bit about his life with us for NAIDOC Week, and thanks Angel Parsons for putting that together. And you should go check Dylan out on Instagram. You can see all his beautiful art. It's so special and I know you'll love it.
Hack.
A longevity diet may help people live longer by fasting for half the day and banning red meat.
On Triple J.
In breaking news, eating better makes you healthier. We hear a lot about fad diets, right? There's always one popping up and generally experts warn that they can do more harm than good. But one diet has a lot of scientists and medical experts talking at the moment. It's called the longevity diet. And there's some research that shows it could help you live up to 20 years longer. 20 years. So what is this new diet? What potions and detoxes have you got to do? Apparently fasting's a part of it. Is that legit? Let's find out. With me is nutritionist Anna Debnam. She's from The Biting Truth. You might see all their tips and recipes on Instagram. Hey, Anna, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Dave, how are you going?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. But I want to know about the longevity diet because I want to live an extra 20 years.
Don't we all?
What's it about?
Yeah, so essentially the longevity diet, it's a set of nutrition guidelines that were developed by a scientist named Valter Longos. I think that's his name. And they're essentially guidelines that are meant to help people live longer and healthier lives. So what he did essentially was analyze hundreds of studies, like nutritional studies, and he looked for any trends and then pulled them together into one, I guess, big nutrition guideline, set of guidelines that can, yeah, help to optimize people's health and life expectancy.
I was reading a bit about what, you know, was included in the diet, and basically what it was saying is eat less meat, more plants, fewer calories. Is there anything really new in that? Is that what experts have been kind of saying for years?
Well, exactly. It is what experts have been saying for years. So there's nothing, you know, excitingly new there. And there's a lot of crossover really with, say, the Mediterranean diet or the flexitarian diet some of you may have heard of. So, and essentially it's, you know, eat more plant-based foods, keep an eye on your animal-based proteins, so things like red meat and chicken and fish and dairy. I guess what is different about it is the fasting component.
Yeah, what is the fasting component? Because it sounds like it could be, you know, a bit weird or even a bit concerning, people not eating for a while.
Yeah, look, when it comes to fasting, fasting certainly isn't for everyone and, in fact, can actually be dangerous for certain groups of people. However, in saying that, it can also benefit some people. So some people do really benefit from fasting, and there's so many different types of fasting diets. So this one, in this diet, kind of advocates to do fasting just like a few times a year, so to do like, you know, a few days a few times a year rather than every single day. So it's a little bit different to what you may have come across before. And yeah, the research in terms of fasting is still a little bit on the fence. So again, it just comes down to you and what's going to be right for you. And what I find for most of my clients is that fasting doesn't suit most people's lifestyles long term.
Well, I guess because the way that we live our lives has changed too, like our working days and everything's changed. Mm. So maybe that has an impact on it. What are scientists saying, like, that it has an impact on our cells, this diet?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, the bottom line is that what we eat does influence our cells, and it's not entirely clear how that exactly happens, like how nutrition can increase our life expectancy. But it is thought, you know, if you take foods like foods that contain antioxidants, so we find them in lots of plant-based foods, it's thought that antioxidants can help to slow down or prevent cell damage, and cell damage is thought to be one of the mechanisms of aging. So, you know, thereby eating lots of foods that contain antioxidants might have benefits in terms of reducing our cells from aging.
Very interesting. Anna Debnam from The Biting Truth, appreciate you coming on and explaining that to us. We had someone text in who said, please be a diet of popcorn chicken. Now, I'm sorry to disappoint you. It wasn't popcorn chicken. And I don't reckon Anna would recommend that for you either. Anna, thanks so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks so much, Dave.
Nate O'Quick.
On Triple J.
Big thanks to nutritionist Anna Debnam from The Biting Truth. And that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.